Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at kpfk.org. My name is Damon Azali, and I'm here with my co-host Manuel Criollo. Last Monday, after weeks of fighting, leaving hundreds dead, a ceasefire was called between Israel and Hezbollah. Joining us to discuss the significance of this recent ceasefire is Nora Erekat, a national grassroots organizer and legal advocate for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. For our second segment, from September 6th through September 10th, a national Latino Congreso will be held here in Los Angeles. Participants will come from all over the country and will include thousands of Latino-led organizations, unions, churches, and over 5,000 U.S. Latino elected officials. Joining us to discuss the significance of this upcoming conference is Celia Brookman of the William C. Velasquez Institute, one of the convening organizations of the event. And finally, we will end our show today with Jesse Milan Jr., chair of the board of directors for Black AIDS Institute, joining us to discuss the victories and the difficulties of the 16th World Conference on AIDS that was held in Toronto last week. Stay tuned, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. Right now we'd like to welcome to the show Nora Erekat, who is a national grassroots organizer and legal advocate for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Nora, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So I hear from my friends that you have tons of information for us, so we're going to kind of go through it kind of quickly. We have about 18 minutes, so just to let you in on that. So in the newspapers and the progressive websites and whatnot, this has been called the victory for Lebanon and Hezbollah, and I wanted to get your opinion on that. Do you agree with that, and why do you or why do you not?
Well, I think the reason that you were seeing this response, this very positive response in terms of how Hezbollah came out of this situation, is not necessarily because they're victorious, but because the standard for victory for them was less. For Hezbollah, their goal was to remain steadfast in withstanding Israeli onslaught, an Israeli attack that had no bounds. Whereas for Israel, their standard for success would have been, in the first instance, the complete annihilation of Hezbollah. In the second instance, the disarming of Hezbollah. And in the third instance, the creation of a buffer zone that stretched from southern Lebanon to north of the Litani River, or about 30 kilometers. So for Israel, none of their goals were actualized, whereas for Hezbollah, whose only goal was to withstand and resist Israel's attack, clearly then they came out the victor. But let's not be too quick. I would not call this a victory. Today, Lebanon bears witness to a million of its population displaced and homeless, its entire infrastructure destroyed, its three major airports, all of its seaports, all of its bridges. We're witnessing environmental catastrophe on the Mediterranean coast. It'll take about 15 years to clean up 10,000 gallons of oil spills off of its coast. We're bearing witness to 1,000 civilians dead, and a country that had just recovered from an awful and very painful civil war. So for those who are declaring this a victory, I would definitely temper that and have to nuance it based on really what our standards look like. The other thing I want to add to that is we also have to be careful about what this victory means and what its, you know, its ramifications could be as an example for other resistance movements. Hezbollah represents really a state within a state in Lebanon. It's not just a political party. It's not just a military resistance to occupation. It provides social services to the Shia people. It provides social services to everybody in need in southern Lebanon. And it's become a state within a state. And other models like that include the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and possibly Hamas before its election to power in the Palestinian government. And I think that for other for other units, organized units like Hezbollah abroad, I would caution that we not take Hezbollah's victory as an example that Israel can be defeated in all instances and that now is the time, you know, to finally end all occupations. The difference between Hezbollah and many of these other organizations is Hezbollah was well prepared. It was well prepared and it was well equipped. It was ready for what happened. And I don't think that if it happened in any other context, in any other country, that the resistance forces would have been able to resist Israel's attacks. And so with all of that, I would just come out saying I don't think anybody came out a winner. I think everybody lost, as war is devastating, occupation is still at hand, and tensions are still high.
Well, why don't you talk to us particularly around what are the terms of the ceasefire? Because it seems like the ceasefire happened, and then people in this country, a lot of people say, oh, okay, it's a ceasefire. But we all know that it's not that simple. So what were the specific terms? What did Hezbollah win out of it? What were some of the stress, the setbacks, et cetera?
Well, I definitely think you're absolutely right that for anybody to see the ceasefire as somehow ending the conflict, we would be remiss to think that really what we're seeing is just kind of an evasion from our television sets and our newspapers. Number one, nothing has stopped. In terms of Israeli attacks, they haven't ceased since the ceasefire was declared last Monday. And then secondly, in terms of what UN Resolution 1701, which is the document outlining the terms of the ceasefire, 1701 demands that Hezbollah be disarmed. But Hezbollah's disarmament is contingent upon international forces taking international forces along with the Lebanese army creating a presence in southern Lebanon. But there's no means of implementation in order for that to happen. UN forces are contingent upon European participation, and European participation is dismal at best. The only European nation that's really eager about establishing a presence is Italy. But the Lebanese want France to step up and actually be present. The other piece of it is that Hezbollah has always demanded, as well as Lebanon, as a nation, has demanded that all of its land be, that the occupation of its lands be ended, and that includes the Sheba farms, which are in the southeast of Lebanon. And the other piece, which is a critical piece, is the fact that the three remaining Lebanese soldiers have not been released. During Israel's 18-year occupation of southern Lebanon, they captured, kidnapped, and imprisoned nearly 300 Lebanese civilians and resistance fighters and farmers. And in a 2004 exchange, all of those prisoners were sent back to Lebanon, except for three. And which is why, which is in part why we witnessed the kidnapping of the two Israeli soldiers. And in exchange for those three Lebanese, those Lebanese prisoners that have yet to be released now for more than 20 years, and the UN Resolution 1701 doesn't articulate anything in terms of the prisoners. So all in all, it's basically a ceasefire that's no more than just that. It's basically a stop. It's kind of it's a recess of war rather than a solution and addressing the major problems that caused this conflict.
Which is a real interesting thing, because I heard George Galloway, who was interviewed on Sky News probably about a couple weeks ago, he kind of said, you know, was pushing back on the Sky News reporter saying, you know, you're acting like this conflict, you know, he said, is only 4 weeks old. But really it's 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And so if you just kind of tuned in now, you might be, you know, kind of on the fence about it. But really, if you go back to the occupation of Lebanon in the 80s and follow it to this particular point, it's not, you can't sit on the fence on it. So can you do in like 2 minutes in terms of how Hezbollah kind of came together and then kind of what is their current status right now?
I could try in 2 minutes, but I think the major point to be made is that, number one, how can an entire nation fall into this rhetoric that this conflict started on July 12th rather than 18 years ago with the occupation? And I would say that it's based on racist assumptions that Arabs want to kill Jews. And that's where we really need to start, that Israel as a nation within the Arab world is an artificial grafting that began in 1948 and that denied the rights of the indigenous population there. So if we could just start from that point of departure, I think it would allow more people when they hear things that, well, Israel has to defend itself because these 22 hostile nations want to kill it, is false, and it's based on racist assumptions about who Arabs are, that somehow they would just have this need to murder and kill and hate, when in fact there's an original sin and a wrong, one that began in 48 for Palestinians and Arabs in general, and that began for Lebanese in 82 in particular. In 1982, when Israel invaded Lebanon, it did so because it wanted to root out the Palestinian Liberation Organization that was based in Beirut. The PLO evacuated in 1984 under U.S. Marine supervision and reestablished itself in Tunis, in Tunisia. Israel did not leave even after the PLO was relocated to Tunis, and instead maintained a presence in southern Lebanon and occupied it until May 24th, 2000. Now, what we're talking about in terms of Hezbollah, when it rose to power, Hezbollah didn't exist in 82 when Israel first invaded Lebanon. It didn't form itself until 1985, 3 years after Israel's initial invasion. At first it was a military force that resisted Israel's attacks, but later after the Lebanese civil war ended in 1990, it established itself as a political party within Lebanon that represented its Shia population. Lebanon is very diverse and has different elements of its population, and Hezbollah represented one of those, which was a Shia population. It became part of the government and has maintained that status so that today it represents almost 40% of the population. In popular opinion polls, it represents, you know, what it's doing is representing 75% of the Lebanese population, including Michel Aoun, General Michel Aoun, who represents a Christian polity. 65% of the Christian polities also support Hezbollah. All that to say that it's not nearly as simple as being a terrorist organization as our mainstream media likes to purport, but instead it's a political organization, it's a social welfare institution, and it's a military resistance to occupation.
This is Damon Azali. We're on the phone with Nora Erikat from the U.S. campaigns in the Israeli occupation. And so just with the last, you know, 5 or 6 minutes, I wanted to kind of bring it back to U.S. interest. And I know one of the things when I first was getting, you know, schooled in the whole history, just like you did a very, very good short take on it, what activists and organizers were telling me was that Israel, being backed by the U.S., was kind of, like you said, an artificial graft on state that was basically there to destabilize and break up the possible union from Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, Iran, Iraq, Palestine, and that was kind of a tactic to basically break up the resistance. So the question I have for you is, based on, one, do you think that is true? And then secondly, is there been any type of unity, both politically and militarily, that goes from, say, Hezbollah to Hamas to some of the other kind of resistance formations in those countries that are actually helping to fight U.S. policy there?
So first, let me address your first point about Israel's formation and why it was formed. In 1948, when Israel was established, the U.S. didn't have much of a role. It was actually the British colonial interest that actually facilitated Israel's establishment. So, and I don't think when it was established in order to resist Arab nationalism or Arab nationalist socialism. Instead, it was a colonial institution meant to take care of Europeans' Jewish problem that I think was based on an anti-Semitism in Western Europe. That's one thing. Later, Israel proved worthwhile, I think, to U.S. imperial interests, namely after 1967 and the Six-Day War, that Israel can literally serve as a watchdog for the U.S. in the Arab world, both in order to suppress popular uprising, to help it maintain its geopolitical strangle on oil in the region, and therefore control abroad. That said, what it's doing today and what it represents today is clearly still in U.S. interest, in the sense that let's just consider the most recent conflict. When Condoleezza Rice, when the entire world demanded ceasefire, and only the U.S. and Israel, and I think one small nation, said no to ceasefire, and the U.S. was the sole veto against ceasefire in the U.N. Security Council. The reason for that wasn't because Israel was to root out Hezbollah. It was totally based on U.S. interest in the region. This is intertwined with the U.S.'s interest in Iran and actually disarming Iran of its nuclear capabilities and its uranium enrichment programs. Seymour Hersh came out with an excellent, excellent article last week that details this U.S.-Israeli collusion about Hezbollah in southern Lebanon and Iran as a nuclear power. And in his research, he found that the U.S. and Israel decided that to serve both of their interests, it would be well worth the time to attack Hezbollah as practice to attack Iran, because if Iran was training Hezbollah with military technology, with its military training, and with the type of infrastructure it was building, then that would serve as a model for how Iran would operate if it were attacked, notwithstanding the fact that Lebanon has a population of 4 million and Iran has a population of 70 million, and that Iran's terrain is completely different in terms of its mountain regions. But that being said, I just wanted to read you a quote of what Dick Cheney's top military aide had said. He's a quote, "The Israelis told us it would be a cheap war with many benefits. Why oppose it? We'll be able to hunt down and bomb missiles, tunnels, and bunkers from the air. It would be a demo for Iran." So in essence, the U.S. supported this war because for them, this was going to be a test run for its own war against Iran. And I think that this just leads us to, we really have to question as proponents of peace and justice, especially, and I want to say something to the anti-war movement, that for those who oppose the U.S.'s presence in Iraq and are concerned with our occupation, with our infinite occupation of Iraq, that we should be equally opposed to Israel's aggression, Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon, Israel's occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, of East Jerusalem, its denial of the right of return. And so long as we don't have a consistent stance against U.S. imperialism, which includes Israel's occupations, then all of our anti-war efforts are short-sighted and the benefits will be short-lived.
Anytime you want to come back on the show, you just let us know. I think that was great. And I want to give out some information in terms of how to get a hold of you. I know your website is www.intheoccupation.org. Is there any other information around what you're doing particularly in the next couple of weeks?
We're having our annual conference in Detroit, where there's the largest Arab American population, including refugees from southern Lebanon, and we'll be discussing our next strategies to oppose U.S.'s support of Israel's occupation and U.S.'s occupation, and really building an anti-apartheid movement that can model the South African anti-apartheid movement. So if folks are interested, it's also on our website. That'll be Labor Day weekend in Detroit, Michigan.
All right, so this was Nora Etiquette from the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back with Celia Brookman from the National Latino Congreso.